Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Professor Saeed Khan explores Syria's extraordinary past, a centre of faith, culture and commerce where civilizations met and ideas flourished. Recorded live at the 2025 festival, uncover the deep historical layers that continue to shape one of the world's most complex nations.
Damascus, which is the capital of Syria, is not exactly a new city. In fact, it holds the distinction of being the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, 11,000 years. And I try to explain this to my students in Detroit. The idea of a city being inhabited for 11,000 years. Detroit is about 350 years old, which puts it at about 100 years older than the United States itself. We simply don't have enough zeros to match that of Damascus, although there's plenty of zeros in Washington, but we can talk about that in the Q&A. But I began to think about this longevity of civilization, and I want to weave this into a broader construct. And again, during the Q&A, feel free to go ahead and raise these topics because they're also interrelated. The idea of a civilization, say Jewish civilization, which marks its calendar in, 5,785 years or something like that. Iranian civilization, which marks its time at about 2,600 years. And how this shapes identity, how this shapes consciousness, how it shapes even the future by which a society sees itself, its values and its priorities. Now, Syria also is important because of geography. And I also explained to my students that while you should focus on ideology, I said much of world history has actually been shaped by geography. It isn't who you are, and it isn't what you believe, but oftentimes it's where you are. And Syria has always been this epicenter. It has always been this crossroads. Remember that Syria played a very big role in serving as a conduit to Europe from Central Asia and further afield, particularly when it came to the Silk Road. And cities like Damascus, cities like Aleppo, were strategically and commercially vital, not just for the region of Syria, not for the broader area of the Middle East, but of the world itself. And it's also fascinating to see today how you have these, how you see these areas of geography starting to, in some cases, resurrect themselves as being vital, as being strategic, as being central. Case in point, Turkey, with a rejuvenation of what had been at one time its gloried position, both in the Silk Road going east and west, as well as a strategic commercial access longitudinally going north to south. The antiquity of Syria, including places like Palmyra, made it a home for the expansion of Alexander the Great, as well as the Romans. Anyone familiar with the brilliant archaeological work at Palmyra? Okay, so we have, of course, Roman amphitheaters there. We have the Temple of Baal, which goes back to about the first or the second century before the Common Era. You know, I know we live in a time of precision, and if we were off by 100 years, there would be a problem when it comes to our accuracy. But when you look at the past, oh yeah, if you're off by 100 years, who's going to care? Moving forward, this was also an area of volatility. And volatility can occur because of the fact that competing forces want control over that area. It's like a courtship where two people are vying for the same person. I have no personal relationship to that concept of being wanted by more than one person at the same time, but I understand that it does occur. But you found that given the locale of Syria, given the resources that it had, and I would say still has, the Romans, particularly the Byzantines, the Persians, were embroiled in a battle, particularly in the 6th century of the Common Era, as to who was going to control this area. Now, while this battle between the great empires was occurring, There was a lot of synergy starting to develop in the Arabian Peninsula. And with the advent of Islam around the early part of the 7th century, we find then that while these two empires were warring with one another, Islam had the opportunity to germinate without necessarily the gaze of these two empires. It was seen as being at this point perhaps unpalatable to try to take control of the Arabian Peninsula, quite frankly, because it was unruly, it was uncohesive. But when Muhammad was able to galvanize the Arabian Peninsula, and shortly after his death in 632, the impetus for expansion became obligatory, in part because now that you have a cohesive whole, the two empires to the north saw the Arabian Peninsula as a potential threat. And similarly, in the whole axiom of kill or be killed, the successors to Muhammad recognized that not only was there an imperative that their leader, the Prophet, had already established to go forward as part of his broader divine, theological, and political vision, but the idea that they wanted to go ahead and make sure that they weren't playing the black pieces in chess, that they were able to be proactive. And 2 years after the Prophet's death, in 634, Muslim armies were in Damascus. And it's interesting that they reached Damascus before they reached Jerusalem. One can think of Jerusalem as being this important center theologically. It is, after all, according to Islamic tradition, the site from where Muhammad made his night journey in about the year 621, ascending to the seven firmaments of heaven from the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or the Dome of the Rock, or now there's the Dome over the Rock. There wasn't one back then. And therefore, it is seen as the third holiest site in Islam. But the caliphs of Islam recognized that trade, commerce, economic buoyancy, economic authority was vital. And they make their way to Damascus, they make their way to Aleppo, and then on the way home, they get Jerusalem in the year 638, driving the Byzantines out, emancipating the city to the Jewish community, which had been banned from Jerusalem, cleaning the Temple Mount, which the Byzantines had turned into a garbage dump. And it's interesting when you think of the garbage dump there, because in the old days, before they used landfills, they used to burn the garbage. And the word for the site in Greek, correct me if I'm wrong, was Gehenna, which is a fascinating etymology, because the word for hell in Arabic it's Jahannam. They go soft G, unless you're in Egypt, and they keep the hard G. That's not code for anything, that's just etymology. But I love the allegory, and I love the visual image of these things. Well, Syria comes under the fold of Islamic rule and remains there until about 1099, when the Crusades, as a way to distract the volatility and the division in Western Europe, becomes a clarion call for Europeans to go to quote-unquote liberate the quote-unquote Holy Land from the quote-unquote infidels. That's a lot of inverted commas. For 1099 until 1187, the Crusaders were successful in the First Crusade. In 1187, on July the 4th, a day which we as Americans observe, shockingly you don't, Salahuddin is able to retake Jerusalem, give the Christian inhabitants, if they choose, safe sanctuary to Christian lands, reopens Jerusalem to Jewish migration, Jewish pilgrimage. And from that point on, despite the fact that there were about six or seven other crusades, the land stays under Muslim rule. But geography still holds vital, particularly in the age of colonization. And Syria gains the eye. If I wanted to go Tolkien on you, I'd say the Eye of Sauron, but that might be a little bit indiscreet, for Europeans. Because now the land of Syria, the land of Palestine, actually this whole area was known as the Greater Syrian Province, and it was part of the Ottoman Empire. It had been so since about 1516, when Selim I, also known as Selim the Grim, He actually wasn't so grim, but he liked to project seriousness, and that's why he was called that. He was also known as Selim the Stern and Selim the Just. The Ottoman Empire takes Syria, and it also takes the very vital province of Egypt away from the Mamluks. This is happening in 1516 and 1517, and just to give you a context of what else is happening in the world, a very disgruntled priest in Germany has a lot of grievances with the Catholic Church. He has fewer grievances than Jay-Z does, and he hangs 95 of these complaints on the door to his local parish church. And he sets off a revolution that hasn't fully been completed yet, which is the Protestant Reformation, and of course I'm talking about Martin Luther. So just to understand what's going on these two areas in a very short region of the world around the Mediterranean. When colonization picks up, the Ottoman Empire comes into the imagination of the Europeans as an empire that is a threat, that is a nuisance, that is an obstacle to reaching Asia and other lands, lands to be controlled, lands to be conquered, and resources to be captured. And we find then that this coincides by the 19th century with a decline of the Ottoman Empire. The empire has grown too vast, too diluted, too diffused, and like any empire, it has a shelf life. You can't be great forever. Not even America. Oh, believe me, I'm sure. If any of you can get in or want to get in, you'll see what's happening. I've actually aged 6 years in the last 6 months. We can talk about that too. Well, anyways, Syria becomes vital because of resources. This is the Fertile Crescent. But there's also something within the imagination of Europe that hasn't really died. And I would call this crusade mentality. The fact that the Europeans were unsuccessful in really taking and holding this land meant that they hadn't really forgotten about it. I mean, think about some of the literature and lore of Europe, including the Song of Roland. Anyone read it? No? Oh, come on, you're supposed to be far more literate and lettered than we are in America. Yeah. We don't even have the Song of Roland on audiobook. So, all right. When it comes to this part of the Middle East, it also proves to be a different locale for a long simmering rivalry in Western Europe between the British and the French. The British have their eyes on the Ottoman Empire, but for them, they're looking at the Suez Canal, and they're also looking more carefully around the Arabian Peninsula, because their priorities are to make sure there is an unfettered route which connects their empire all the way from the metropole here in the UK to areas further afield in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and in Oceania. For the French, as Glenn Close said in Fatal Attraction, they didn't want to be ignored. And so they wanted to make sure that they had a foothold in this area as well. Enter French engagement with what we know today as Syria and Lebanon. And the French were able to exploit factionalism that had started to build up amongst communities that by and large had gotten along for quite a while. These would be the Arab Christian communities and the Arab Muslim communities. Unfortunately, there was a governor in the middle of the 19th century in Syria by the name of Ibrahim, who decided that he was going to disarm the Muslims, even though he was Muslim, and he was going to disarm the Christians, because disarmament meant it would create greater social order and an easier way to control the population, despite the fact that these were more frontier and rustic communities for whom gun culture would be similar to what you would find in places like Wyoming or South Dakota or North Dakota or these other rectangular states that people just simply fly over when they're going to California in America. Unfortunately, in order for him to do this, Ibrahim decided the best tactic was to pit these communities against one another. And so what we find then is what is known as confessional politics develops in Syria. The Maronites start to become circumspect of the Muslims. The Muslims in kind become circumspect of the Christian populations. The French come in around the middle of the 19th century and bring with them, and here, of course, is one of these wonderful ironies, and one might even consider contradictions, that as secular as France was becoming after the French Revolution, and as laïcité was starting to institutionalize itself in France, the French really leaned into religious difference when it came to the Middle East. And in fact, they tended to privilege the Arab Christian population in what was known in France as the Levant. In 1860, when there was a civil war in this region between Muslim and Christian factions, the French demanded, successfully were able to effectuate, that the Ottomans establish a carved-out area along the coast of the Eastern Mediterranean, known as a Mutasarafia, a district, which was going to be governed by a non-Ottoman Christian. Now, we can talk a lot about breaches of sovereignty of late, but the very idea that the French were able to make this demand and that the Ottomans felt compelled to honor it shows you how weak the Ottomans had become by this point. And so essentially, you now have an area that was governed in a de facto way, or at least supplied and supported by the French. It also coincided with missionary work that the French were doing in this region. And they established schools, and they established other institutions. Now, these schools also gained the allure of a certain bandwidth of Levantine population that was not confined to just the Christian side of the aisle. It was socioeconomically driven. Why? Because Europe was now seen as, and I know this is inverted because the sun rises in the east, but at least metaphorically, the region now saw with the rise of modern Europe that the sun was rising in the west. And as such, with the new zeitgeist coming online, those who could afford it wanted to be educated in the paradigms of the new world. And so the best and the brightest also happened to come from the wealthiest families. And it became a bit of a status symbol. That is why, to this day, when I ask some of my students, because Detroit has a very large Arab population, if they know where their grandparents went to school, by and large, they'll say, we don't know the full name, but we know it began with the word saint. And this, of course, was something that we've seen elsewhere in the colonial world, especially in South Asia. I remember my mom telling me that she went to St. Xavier's in Bombay, and she gives me grief for being too much of an Anglophile, because I passed the Tebbit test. I support England in cricket. And her attitude is like the Ramones when they sang the KKK took my baby away. Well, so the idea that what this infrastructure was creating. Now, I don't know how nefarious and well premeditated this was by the French, but it created a class of people who essentially had colonized minds. Those who were, perhaps in a very implicit way, taught about French and more broadly European superiority. And this included Muslims as well. It also taught them that French was a superior language, and it became the lingua franca of the elite, to the point where it subsumed Arabic as being seen as an inferior language. So understand the decoupling that is now going on to a certain kind of cultural base in the region as it is being effectuated by the French intervention here. Well, fast forward, World War I occurs, and it doesn't go very well for the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire collapses by the end of, well, it actually called for a ceasefire about 2 weeks before the armistice in November. But what we find then is a plan that had been underway during the war on how to divide the Middle East. Some of you are familiar with the Balfour Declaration, but before the Balfour Declaration, there was the Sykes-Picot Agreement of May the 9th, 2016, which I have to think was like a Christmas wish list between the British and the French that if they could, how would they divide up this map? And by the way, the Europeans were obsessed with maps. I used to like atlases, but I don't know if anybody even cracks one open now because there's Google Map. What the French recognized was that the British were quite dominant. They had the Suez Canal, which they bought from the Egyptians in 1875 when the Egyptians could no longer afford to pay back the loans on it. In fact, the Egyptians didn't pay back the loans on the Suez Canal until 1952. I thought my mortgage was long. But does anyone know who built the Suez Canal? Just don't tell me the same people that built the pyramids. The French! The French completed it. Ferdinand de Lesseps constructed the Suez Canal. It was completed in 1869. It must have really chafed the French that the British came in and bought it on the cheap. Maybe that's why the French... No, I won't make a joke about it. But what happens is at the same time, oil, as being an alternative fuel source, is starting to develop. Does anyone know who wrote the memo in the Royal Navy who advocated for the idea of switching from coal to oil? It was Churchill, Lord Mountbatten. No, he was, you know, that would have been pretty impressive because he would have been like about 8. And I know Mountbatten used to take credit for everything, and he would have tried for that, but it wasn't that. He was preparing for being viceroy, I think, his whole life, though. What happened now for the British was the Tigris and the Euphrates on one side, the Nile on the other, and they wanted everything in between. The problem was they recognized that the French had very legitimate investment in the Levant, the northern part of the greater Syrian provinces, what today is Syria and Lebanon. And they said, all right, I guess begrudgingly we should give them their share, since they've invested in it. But the British also were mindful that the really heavy lifting part of World War I was happening in France. The trenches weren't in Lancashire, they were in the Loire. So understanding that the French were going to then demand, when the war was over, a certain amount of recompensation, the British decided to be very charitable. They said, yeah, we'll pay you back. It just won't be from us, it'll be from the Ottoman Empire. It's like raiding your neighbor's refrigerator. And this is the genesis of, pardon the pun for the region, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The area of Syria and Lebanon would be under French control. The area below that, going all the way from Mosul in Iraq, sweeping across the Sinai to the border and barrier of the Suez Canal, would be under British control. According to the original plan of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the area between the Jordan and the Mediterranean was going to be known as an international condominium. It was not going to be either the British or the French controlling it. That changed dramatically after the Balfour Declaration and the establishment of the British Mandate of Palestine, which went even farther east than just the Jordan River. This was codified in a document known as the Treaty of Sèvres. The Treaty of Versailles only applied to Germany, but the Treaty of Sèvres is what then codifies the division of this region and was almost verbatim to what had been decided and determined by the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Now, if you've ever seen a map of the Middle East, you know that some of the borders and boundaries between these countries don't exactly follow natural geographic lines like mountains or rivers or lakes or seas. Some of them are 45-degree angles. And this was entirely because bureaucrats in London and Paris wanted to prioritize what their needs and wants and likes were, without giving regard to severing populations that had been there, obviously, for millennia. It explains why Iraq looks the way it does, it explains why Jordan looks the way it does, and it explains how Syria and Lebanon look the way that they do. Now, the French mandate was of Lebanon and Syria, and during the mandate period, as established by the League of Nations, they ruled it as one, but they privileged Lebanon as being a bit unique as it served to protect, in their mind, the Arab Christian community. As far as Syria itself, the vast majority of the country was divided into two provinces, one known as Aleppo and the other known as Damascus. And cryptically, these were named after the two major cities in these provinces. In the northwest, there was the province of Latakia, and in the south, there was what was known as Jabal Druze. And from 1925 to 1927, there was a massive revolt that was led by the Druze, much more of a frontier population, a tribal population, which was quite brutally clamped down by the French. The French, during the Mandate period, definitely were more brutal than even the British were in how they conducted things. The British would allow, to use the metaphor, their Mandate people to drive the car a little bit, which prepared these countries to make the transition to independence far more smoothly than Syria and Lebanon did when the Mandate period finally ended. The French really did rule Syria and Lebanon with an iron claw. There was a glimmer of hope in 1936 when a socialist was elected president in France by the name of Léon Blum. And he sued for the eventual independence or the end of the mandate for Syria. Unfortunately, his rule didn't last very long, and then World War II begins. And as you know, in 1940, France is occupied by Germany, and a new regime comes in known as the Vichy, led by Marshal Pétain. And Pétain said, "We have zero tolerance for anything which might jeopardize Syria and Lebanon," and so he leaned into more direct control by the French. Well, there was a pledge made by the Free French and the British that if this territory could be liberated, and if the Vichy could be removed, then, at the time, General Charles de Gaulle, the leader of the Free French, said, "Well, maybe we'll consider giving Syria its independence." Well, they were successful in 1943, but de Gaulle reneged on that pledge. But the war ends, and there is a realization that the Europeans cannot hold on to their mandates any longer. And we saw, of course, this process of demanditization when it comes to the British in 1947 in Palestine, the efforts and the attempts for the UN partition plan, which fails, and then the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. But Syria and Lebanon do become independent. The problem, though, was because the French had so poorly equipped them for autonomous political rule, that Syria plunges into a state of political chaos. In the year 1949 alone, there are three military coups d'etat. And there's another series of these going all the way into 1954. At the same time, it's also important to remember that Syria and Egypt were the cultural heart of the Arab world. They were the cultural producers of poetry, of music, of the entertainment field as a whole, and of literature. When Nasser comes to power in Egypt, we find then that there is an imbalance because along with that kind of cultural efflorescence, Egypt becomes the force that stands up to not only the old colonial guard, but also to what is perceived to be the colonial outpost in the region, which is the State of Israel. And in 1956, when the Suez Crisis happens, Nasser is able to stare down all three. It is, as they say, the time when the sun finally did set on the British Empire, in part because of Prime Minister Anthony Eden's arrogance of trying to go in and retake the Suez Canal that Nasser had nationalized. But did you know that after Nasser became a bit of a demigod in 56, Syria and Egypt, for a brief while, were one country known as the United Arab Republic? They said, "We will go ahead and consolidate, bring the best of the Arab world together, and be then a bulwark against not only local aggression, local nuisance, but also maybe we can actually stave off and stay out of that thing known as the Cold War, where we have to decide between Team America or Team Soviet Union." They were looking to be non-aligned. They had their own currency, they had their own stamps. Unfortunately, I think on most of the stamps, it was just Nasser. And that was part of the problem. In the United States, in the 1990s, Daimler-Benz had a merger with Chrysler. Except after a while, people realized it was not a merger of equals. And the joke around Detroit was, how do you say Daimler Chrysler, the name of the new company, in German? The answer is Daimler, because Chrysler is silent. And in many ways, Syria was equally silent in this relationship, and ultimately, it was not a marriage that lasted. At the same time, Arab nationalism and Arab secular socialism was the rage of the day. I know it seems hard to believe that now, but if you take a look at Gamal Abdel Nasser, and if you take a look at people like Kamil Shamoun, the leader of Lebanon, and if you take a look at the leadership within Syria, no one talked about the kind of desecularized rhetoric that we have today that we take for granted. Everything was about pan-Arab nationalism. Everything was about a socialist model to serve as a healthy medium between Soviet communism and Western capitalism. Enter the Ba'ath Party, which has different manifestations, one of them in Iraq, but the one in Syria becomes very fascinating. It becomes dominated by the military and people from the military. Now, why would this be important? As I mentioned before, the vast majority of Syria was composed and comprised of Sunni Muslims. And they tended to be urban-based in places like Damascus and Aleppo. And in doing so, it turned out that they were the engineers, they were the business people, they were the doctors, they were the technocrats. And during the French Mandate period, there was, of course, a Syrian army. But Sunni Muslims would discourage and dissuade their sons from joining the army because they saw that army as being the army of the French and doing the bidding of the French. They said, why do you want to do that? And the other thing was, why would you join the army when you can operate in the family business or because of a certain level of nepotism, you will easily find a successful job? Those groups that were marginalized were those who were the Jabal Druze, who didn't want to be involved anyway because they were more of a frontier people, and the people in the northwest in Latakia province. Well, who were they? They were a group of people known as the Alawites. In America, one of the fascinating elements of immigration there is that Irish Catholics were generally shunned from certain quarters and corridors of employment. And that is one of the reasons why today you will find both the tradition of and still the critical mass of Irish Catholics associated with the police departments and the fire departments in many cities like Boston and Chicago and New York, just to name a few. Well, similarly, the Alawites, finding few spaces to go to, ended up in the army. It wasn't by some grand conspiracy, it was just one of the few spaces that they could find. Well, fast forward to now an independent Syria, and when the Ba'ath Party is drawing a lot of its support from and its leadership from the army, it's not surprising then that we find the rise of the Alawites within the political system of the country. One of these individuals happens to be a colonel in the Syrian Air Force by the name of Hafiz al-Assad. And by 1971, he's able to take control of the country. And so now you have the leader of the Ba'ath Party, you have an Alawite, and it is therefore no surprise that his leadership around him all are Alawites as well, because he draws from the military ranks. All right? Fast forward. Hafiz al-Assad, of course, needs to stay in power. He sees the Sunni Muslim population with a certain level of resentment, maybe even contempt, and he also sees them as a potential danger because of their numbers and because of their collective wealth. And when there is political oppression in the early 1980s, Hafiz al-Assad is very deft at clamping down. And we find in certain cities like Homs and Hama, the clampdown is particularly brutal. And this is something that is not forgotten by these populations moving forward, particularly in 2000 when he dies, and Syria is now run by his son, a UK-trained ophthalmologist by the name of Bashar al-Assad. Now fast forward a little bit more, and we come into 2011. The Arab Spring had commenced a few weeks earlier at the end of December when Mohamed Bouazizi, a produce seller in Tunisia, decided to take on a very dramatic act of political dissent by self-immolating when he felt that he was humiliated by a police officer who demanded that he present a license for selling vegetables off his cart. He dies, but he then becomes the figurehead of a movement which then removes a leader who had been in control in Tunisia, Zain Abidine Ben Ali, for decades. The Arab Spring spreads to Egypt, where in a matter of 3 weeks, three decades long leader like Hosni Mubarak is removed as well. The Arab Spring comes to Syria, and Bashar al-Assad has zero tolerance for it, and he clamps down. This then begins what some call a civil war. We can talk about the semantics or debate the semantics about whether it was a true civil war or not. But nonetheless, we find then that several factions are involved in this conflict. And part of the confusion of the conflict in Syria simply becomes who's on whose side. I would argue that from the American perspective, the United States decided that they were going to outsource what was happening in Syria to some of its regional allies. And the confusion began where each of these allies seemed to have a different priority. You have Turkey, you have the United States, you have Gulf states as well. For the United States, their stated issue with what was going on in Syria was at least giving some lip service to say Assad must go. But they were most concerned with the rise of what is known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, also known as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also known as Daesh, so ISIS, ISIL, or Daesh. The Turks didn't really care much about ISIS. For them, they were looking for a way to curb the aspirations of the Kurds in the north of Syria to developing an independent Kurdish state, because that would also include parts of eastern Turkey as well. For many of the Gulf countries, it seemed as though the idea of a free Syria that was even, dare we say, democratic, would prove to be a very powerful rejoinder to what the Gulf states were trying to assert, that the only stable Islamic regimes are ones that are run by monarchies, that you really cannot trust them if they are democratic. So it didn't bode well for them to support the Free Syrian Army. There were other options available. There was Jabhat al-Nusra, which was al-Qaeda in the region. And when that, for some people, proved to be too tame, that is how we get ISIS. Now, fast forward to the very current, and I think for many, it caught them off guard last year, where on December the 8th, we have what were known as the rebels, led by Ahmed al-Sharra, also known as al-Jilani, formerly of Jabhat al-Nusra, but by his own account, having left the movement. His group of dissidents then, through a lightning sweep, is able to reach Damascus. And on December the 8th, the Assad family leaves Damascus under the cover of the Russians, and they are currently in Moscow, where they apparently have quite a large property holding portfolio. I remember December the 8th, 2024, because for me, it's the day John Lennon died in 1980. So, you know, I've got my priorities. But I think what's really happening today, and then I'll open it up to questions because I'm mindful of the time here, is what's next. And right now, there's still a lot of confusion about how did it happen as quickly as it did, and who really stands to benefit. As some of you know, President Trump has seemingly welcomed this development because the United States has said that it will lift the sanctions on Syria, which it has. But what was very peculiar about it is, given the transactional nature of the American president, he seemed to lift the sanctions without asking for anything in return. I'm sure there must be something going on, but that hasn't been disclosed or divulged as of yet. Who has won from this? One can argue certainly the Syrian opposition to Assad. The Syrian expatriate community, particularly that in the United States, and more specifically the Sunni Muslim community that is Syrian, are absolutely jubilant. They see this as final retribution and promise toward a more free Syria, something that they haven't seen in the last 54 years since the Assad regime, father and son, took over. Iran, of course, has lost a major strategic ally and client in Damascus. And as a result of that, we find other groups, including Hezbollah, for whom Syria served as a conduit, have also suffered from this. Turkey has been able to demonstrate that it is a regional change maker, an influencer, I guess in Gen Z terminology. But after that, we also have still uncertainty about whether this was a net positive or a net negative for countries like Israel, for the Gulf states. And I think that that perhaps is a reflection of just simply still how fluid the situation is. Because when I mentioned that Assad has been gone on December 8th, 2024, that's only 7 months. And I know that in this day and age, a lot can happen in 7 months. I mean, America can change in only 6 months. So I think it's important for us to then understand that in this area that is still vital, that is still central geographically and in other ways, it's an important country to examine and to pay attention to see which way it goes. For no other reason than for the fact that the people of Syria were so displaced and so beleaguered for so long, for some semblance of stability and security to come back to them, but also to then recognize where does it fit into these broader geopolitical and geostrategic conversations we're having. With that, I'd like to open it up to any questions. Thank you. I think that's all I had on my slides, but no, Hisham, that was a joke. The slides weren't working. Yes, sir.
Russia invested quite a lot in supporting the Assad regime. Yeah. Have they given up any interest in the area, do you think?
That's a great question. So Russia had for decades had some influence in the region, but I would argue not directly. Their chief way of engagement in the region was as an arms supplier. Certainly Syria was a very good customer, as had been Egypt until 1972. But more recently, Russia had more direct intervention. And this again was unprecedented in the history of the region. An air force base, but more importantly, the naval base at Tartus, which is Russia's chief naval base and servicing center in the Eastern Mediterranean. The next closest one is on the other side of the Bosphorus in, you guessed it, Sevastopol in Crimea. Interestingly enough, it doesn't seem as though al-Sharqa has told the Russians to leave. And so it also is interesting that doesn't seem as though it is something that the West or the United States has pressured al-Sharqa to go ahead and the Russians reduce their footprint there. So there's a certain modus vivendi that's in place.
So I understand it, since the takeover at the end of last year, Israel has felt free to bomb and bomb and bomb as they wish to make sure that the new Syrian regime will have no military capacity and independence whatsoever.
This is absolutely true. So the question for those of you who couldn't hear or the comment is that as soon as al-Sharqa came into power, Israel actually expanded its influence and its military intervention, particularly in the south. It fortified its position in the Golan Heights, which it took in 1967 in the Six-Day War, which according to international law, especially UN Resolution 242 and 336, is still illegal. It was unfortunate that American administrations, including the Trump administration, said that Israel has a right to the claim it makes over the Golan. I know, I mean, you got to forgive me. I mean, I haven't checked the news in the last hour. No, I'm serious. I mean, the news is changing in America that quickly. Did the Diddy verdict come in? Yeah, sorry. But this whole idea then of the impunity that you are describing, when we think of the impunity that is underway regarding Iran or other conflicts in the region, in many ways, the military intervention in Syria just set the die to be cast by Israel. We can make the argument that al-Sharqa was unable to push back to try to resist what Israel is doing. either because of priorities or because of limitations on his own military capacity. But unfortunately, there's this other element that's coming in, and that is, if he's not doing anything about it, is he actually supporting what Israel is doing, it, or is he being acquiescent to what Israel is doing? And again, because there's no answers and there's no coherence to things, people are allowing their darker angels to take over, that this is just part of a grander conspiracy of nation building. And this is not by any means helped. There is an organization known as the Committee for Regional Security, which is an Israeli company, which actually has a photograph of a new Middle East, which has Netanyahu in the middle, has al-Shara, and has the emirs of the Gulf countries, especially those of the Abraham Accords, and more aspirationally, some of the others that they're trying to draw into it, all from the standpoint of creating concentric circles of protection for Israel, spanning from Morocco in Northwest Africa all the way to Iraq. Iran is actually conveniently not even on the map of the Middle East in this model. So,
President Trump told us a number of times how handsome he found the new Syrian president. I was wondering if you could give us your verdict.
I think it's pretty hot, too. Come on, Mom. What, really?
My more serious question was, he also mentioned that, I believe, Mohammed bin Salman and President Erdogan had both asked him to remove their sanctions on Syria. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about what their goals are?
I couldn't hear that. Erdogan and...
asked him to remove sanctions on Syria, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what Saudi and Turkey's goals are.
Well, I think one of the goals is to have some level of stability, and that is going to then serve as a curb to the kind of volatility that could be exploited in the minds of Erdogan, where the Kurds could rise up. For Mohammed bin Salman, I think he's also looking at this possibility of what kind of influence he can exert. There's a reciprocity that's going on. And I'm glad that you asked the question, because there are two, centers of gravity in the region. This is actually part of a rivalry between Riyadh and Ankara as to who is the bigger influencer in the region. Is it Turkey or is it Saudi Arabia? So Turkey by far has been responsible for enabling al-Shara to come and to remove al-Assad. But MBS doesn't want to be left out of the game. There's a lot of FOMO going on there, and so he's then offering. And the one thing that, of course, Saudi Arabia has is that they can come in with financial aid to help build an infrastructure which has really suffered over the last 14 years. We have time for, about one or two questions. One more question. Thanks, Rose. All right. Any questions?
What about the Kurds? Where do they fit in with this new picture?
It's over for the Kurds, in the sense that there's a few things that I think bear attention. To show that they have essentially conceded the fact that an independent Kurdish state, other than the semi-autonomous state of Kurdistan in the north of Iraq, is going to have to simply be a pipe dream. Abdullah Öcalan, who was the leader of AK, the main Kurdish opposition and resistance group in Turkey, which has been designated a terrorist organization for decades in Turkey, conceded from jail, saying that the fight is over. And I thought that that was quite telling, because Öcalan is the most visible the aspiration of an independent Kurdistan. And for him to essentially throw in the towel or raise the white flag means that it's not something that is tenable, winnable, or achievable. Well, with that, thank you so much. It's, again, always wonderful. If you have any questions, I'm around. I'm not leaving Bradford until, I'll watch them turn the lights off. But thank you for being here for the festival and being at this session.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.